This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'll turn it over now to Jean-Michel Robertet. He's a professor of English and Comparative Literature at the University of Pennsylvania. So.
Thank you very much, Helen. And I'm just happy to hear that Richard knows Osvaldo. So this is another sign that, as quite often in the past, our paths have intersected, and Richard's an old friend. And I remember inviting him, I think in 92, to talk about Rorty and Habermas. And I'd say that Richard, among lots of other things, and an enormous, let's say, level of activity and commitment, is right now chair of philosophy at Temple, has managed to write on many topics, but among which pragmatism, and I owe him the discovery of American pragmatism, among other things. I'll just list his publications, since it's interesting to know how varied his interests have been. He started with two books on literary criticism, The Object of Literary Criticism, 1984, T.S. Eliot and the Philosophy of Criticism, 1988. Then he edited The Analytic Aesthetics, 89, The Interpretive Turn, 91. In 1992, he published Pragmatist Aesthetics, Living Beauty, Rethinking Art. A version of it that was extremely successful in France was Sous l'Interprétation. In 1997, he published Practicing Philosophy, Pragmatism and the Philosophical Life. He edited The Critical Reader of the Bourdieu Critical Reader. In 1999, I think he published in French earlier, La fin de l'expérience esthétique, and in 2000, Performing Live, Aesthetic Alternatives for the Ends of Art. So it's not enough to say that Richard is pragmatist, whatever that means. He's that, yes, and lots of other things. But what I've always enjoyed in Richard's contributions, whether written, oral, or his various interventions in lots of places around the world, is that he's always tried to link theory and practice, which, after all, is one of the major issues of this series, and that his philosophy, and he's a professional philosopher, is a philosophy in action, a philosophy of the living body, a philosophy of style. He's capable of mediating between abstract discussion of Rorty, Habermas, Nietzsche, Foucault, Bourdieu, and discussions of rap music, bodybuilding, dancing, piercing, and so on. I also want to mention, this was mentioned in a little handout, that he has single-handedly animated for now 2 years the monthly discussions at Barnes & Noble's Dialogues on the Square, and I've not only been invited a few times, but come regularly. And it's, for me, a very exciting attempt at recreating what has flourished in Europe these last years under the name, French name, Café Philosophique, Philosophical Cafés, where you have people who discuss really abstract topics in philosophy, but coming from whichever background. For Richard, it seems that these recent years, the focus of his work has been the investigation of the social function of art. Art understood not just as elitist accumulation of savoir-faire, or in Bourdieu's terms, as distinction, but art as experience, not divorced from everyday concerns. And art can mean as well the art of dressing, of eating, and of enjoying oneself. So this is why let's welcome him today. He will talk about art as dramatization.
Thanks very much, Jean-Michel. I mean, I actually know Osvaldo from a previous life when I was an Israeli. I think I had just come back from Oxford, and he hired me to teach theory at the Israeli art economy, Bezalel. Yeah. It's good to be here. It's nice and cozy and gemütlich. The first time I gave this talk, I gave it in German at the Frankfurt Opera, followed by Don Giovanni, and I was terrified. There were 800 paying people in the auditorium, and fortunately I couldn't see any of them because, you know, it's spotlight and the audience is in darkness. So this is a more intimate setting, but I can see you, and I know I'm being recorded, but I know it's not for security reasons, which is also a change from my past life in Israel, where sometimes people wanted to record my philosophy classes as a demonstration of security needs in the university. So the lecture today won't give too much of a preview, but Jean-Michel was kind enough to talk about my schizoid interests. And this paper is an attempt to try to bring them together. And it looks like I may be dealing with my personal problems of fragmentation, but I think they reflect not only my hang-ups, but the ruptures in the field. So the original title was Tatort, Art as Dramatization. Tatort is the German term for scene of the crime. It's also the name of I think, my favorite and the most popular German detective show. So it will come into the paper, so I want to make sure that you know what it means. And the word, actually, Tatort, comes from two German smaller words. Tat is act and Ort is place, but its meaning is scene of the crime. Okay, Tatort, Art as Dramatization. Dramatize, dramatize, was the insistent cry that haunted Henry James' artistic genius. The celebrated novelist knew himself a failure in the theater. His plays were almost all rejected for production, and one of the only two produced was roundly booed on the London stage. Yet James realized with brave honesty that the basic principle of drama nonetheless held the key to artistic greatness. Distinguishing nicely between the terms theater stuff and drama stuff, between concrete stage performance and what he called the deeper divine principle of the scenario, equally realizable in novels, movies, and television, James turned that essential dramatic principle more consciously to work in composing the later works of fiction that crown his great career. The scenic method, he writes, is my absolute, my imperative, my only salvation, end of quote. That salvation is evident in his posthumous dramatic success, in the frequent adaptations of his fiction into TV dramas, films, and even into two operas by Benjamin Britten. James' assertion of the drama's superiority could have rested on ancient philosophical authority, but it was also not uncommon in his own time and after. Nietzsche, for example, just a year younger than James, was quick to affirm Richard Wagner's recognition that, I quote, the greatest influence of all the arts could be exercised through the theater, end of quote. Some generations later, James' native countryman and fellow Anglophile T.S. Eliot would reaffirm the supremacy of drama as, I quote, the ideal medium for poetry, end of quote. Combining the power of meaningful action with the beauty of musical order, poetic drama could capture two exquisitely precious and different kinds of aesthetic value, not easily synthesized in a single form. And through its theatrical performance, Eliot further argued, drama enabled the poet to reach, I quote, as large and as miscellaneous an audience as possible, end of quote. Eliot therefore made his own sustained efforts to write for the theater, where, however, he enjoyed only little more initial success than James. The Broadway hit Cats, though based on Eliot's light verse, is a posthumous dramatization of poetry that he, in fact, never intended for theater, let alone musical theater. Considered from the point of view of practicing artists, rather than that of philosophers, drama's preeminence derives not only from its presumed ability to reach more people and move them more powerfully and completely than other arts, something that may be truer today for cinema than for theater. There is also, dare I say it as an American, I have a dual nationality, so I can say that. There is also, dare I say it as an American, the charm that a successful theater play could bring in the quickest, if not always ultimately, the greatest income to its author. We know from private correspondence that money was certainly one motive for James' interest in writing for the theater. But the presence of this motive in no way falsifies the sincerity of his adulation of drama, which he praised as, quote, the noblest of arts, end of quote, long before he ever seriously thought of a career in playwriting. James thought drama was noblest because the most challenging, combining the gravest formal demands of masterly structure with the highest requirement of significance of subject. In my paper tonight, I want to go beyond these more familiar assertions of drama's preeminent influence and nobility in order to suggest that the concept of drama embodies and unites two of the deepest, most important conditions of art and may therefore hold the key to a useful definition of art as a whole. Those familiar with my aesthetic theory may be surprised at these claims, since I have always been critical of essentialist definitions of art, whether as form, mimesis, expression, organic unity, and so forth, definitions that claim to define the concept of art once and for all by a single set of necessary and sufficient conditions that neatly divide all actual and possible objects into those that are art and those that are not art. I further criticized essentialist definition for its role in what I call wrapper theories of art. That's wrapper, W-R-A-P-P-E-R. With me, you have to make the distinction. Theories that seek more to cover, conserve, and contain the aesthetic status quo rather than to explain or improve our concept of art. My critique of wrapper theory essentialism does not mean, however, that all definitions of art must be misguided failures. This is because there are other functions of definition than the positing of unchanging essences. From my pragmatist perspective, the value of a definition of art is in its contribution to art's understanding and experience. Definitions can be useful as devices to emphasize certain features of art that may not be receiving enough attention. Definitions may also help us bring together various aspects of art into a more perspicuous constellation by combining features or reconciling orientations that otherwise seem uncomfortably unconnected or even in conflict. So if the value of aesthetic definition depends on its capacity to improve our understanding and appreciation of art, what use could there be in defining art as dramatization? I shall argue that this definition is at least useful in integrating and thus reconciling the two most potent general orientations that dominate and polarize contemporary aesthetic theory. We can call these orientations naturalism and historicism. Naturalism defines art as something deeply rooted in human nature, which therefore finds expression in one form or another in virtually every culture. This view, which is at least as old as Aristotle, sees art as arising from natural human needs and drives, a natural inclination toward mimesis, a natural desire for balance, form, or meaningful expression, a thirst for a kind of enhanced aesthetic experience that gives the live creature not only pleasure, but a more vivid, heightened sense of living. Art, it argues, is not only deeply grounded in natural forces, energies, and rhythms, but is also an important tool for the survival and perfection of human nature. Hence, for many proponents of aesthetic naturalism, the highest art, the most compelling drama, is the art of living. Even when art is significantly shaped by the societies, cultures, and specialized frameworks in which it is situated, the naturalists insist that art at its best, truest, and most potent expresses the fullness and power of life. This line of aesthetic naturalism made its mark in German philosophy through Friedrich Nietzsche. In his early study of drama's origins in ancient Greece, The Birth of Tragedy, Nietzsche argues that art was born of natural roots. I'm exciting him now, and I'll do it in English this time. An expression of overflowing life or lively action arising from the innermost ground of man, even from the very depths of nature, from an overflowing health, from a fullness of being, end of quote. The heightened experience of aesthetic ecstasy, which Nietzsche traces from early Greek tragedy back to the religious frenzy of Dionysian ritual, is championed, as I quote, as the highest expression of nature, end of quote. In contrast, he condemns the culture of opera and its stilo representativo, and I quote, as something completely unnatural, end of quote. Emerging from the deepest wells of nature, true art celebrates, and again a long quote, celebrates through its aesthetic delight the principle of eternal life beyond all appearance and despite all destruction, end of quote. For Nietzsche then, one last quote from Nietzsche, for Nietzsche then, art is not simply an imitation of nature, but its metaphysical supplement, a justification of the world as an aesthetic phenomenon, end of quote. John Dewey, a major influence on my pragmatist aesthetics, plies a similar doctrine of naturalism. He insists that art, the mode of activity charged with meaning capable of immediately enjoyed possession, is the culmination of nature, while science itself, an art of sorts, is properly a handmaiden that conducts natural events to this happy issue. That's a quote from Art is Experience. Aesthetic understanding, Dewey urges, must never forget that the roots of art and beauty lie in the basic vital functions, the biological commonplaces that man shares with bird and beast. Even in our most sophisticated fine arts that seem most removed from nature, and I quote, the organic substratum remains as the quickening and deep foundation, the sustaining source of the emotional energies of art, whose true aim is to serve the whole creature in his unified vitality. Underneath the rhythm of every art and of every work of art, there lies, Dewey concludes, the basic pattern of relations of the live creature to his environment, so that naturalism, in the broadest and deepest sense of nature, is a necessity of all great art, end of quote. The impassioned aesthetic naturalisms of both Nietzsche and Dewey share a common but insufficiently acknowledged source in Ralph Waldo Emerson, the transcendentalist prophet who ardently and everywhere preached the gospel of nature in all its manifold forms, uses, and resplendent spirituality. Art is just one example. Art, as Emerson defines it, and I quote, is nature passed through the alembic of man, end of quote. Rather than serving art for art's sake, art's aim is to advance nature by enhancing the life of its human expression. Thus, Emerson continues, and I quote, art should exhilarate by engaging one's whole energy and serving fully the functions of life. There is higher work for art than the arts, Emerson concludes. Nothing less than the creation of man and nature is its end, end of quote. Emerson anticipates Dewey's argument that art takes its very forms and symbols from our natural environment. For example, the pointed style of Gothic architecture, from the forest towering trees. Emerson likewise prefigures the celebration of the intense sublimity of aesthetic experience that both Dewey and Nietzsche later emphasize as the highest achievement of culture, peak experiences that are more profoundly transformative and creatively insightful than any discursive truth of science. The poet gives us the eminent experiences only, writes Emerson, a god stepping from peak to peak. Poetry, Emerson continues, in a phrase that Nietzsche later made more famous, poetry is the gay science, and the poet a truer logician, one who unlocks our chains and admits us to a new scene, end of quote. The aesthetic naturalism of these philosophers is more than romantic sentimentalism. Contemporary science lends it significant support. evolutionary researchers now recognize that by and large, the things that naturally give us pleasure are good for the survival and growth of our species. Since we have survived and evolved not by conscious planning, but by making the choices that natural pleasures have unreflectively drawn us to. The intense pleasures of sex, for example, impel us toward procreation for the survival of the species, even if it is not in the individual's rational best interest to take the risks involved in such dangerously close encounters. Art's beauty and pleasures, it can be argued, have evolutionary value not only for sharpening our perception, manual skill, and sense of structure, but also for creating meaningful images that help bind separate individuals into an organic community through their shared appreciation of symbolic forms. Finally, art's pleasures, by their very pleasure, have evolutionary value in that they make life seem worth living, which is the best guarantee that we will do our best to survive. The long survival of art itself, its passionate pursuit despite poverty and oppression, and its pervasively powerful transcultural presence can all be explained by such naturalistic roots. For as Emerson, Nietzsche, Dewey, and other life-affirming aestheticians have realized, there is something in the vividness and intensity of art's experience that heightens our natural vitality by responding to deeply embodied human needs. The quickening transformative power of aesthetic experience that the naturalists stress as the energizing core of art need not be confined to wholly positive experiences of unity and pleasure, as my quotes from Emerson, Nietzsche, and Dewey might suggest. Naturalism extends beyond happy affirmations of organic wholeness, since nature not only unifies but disturbs and divides. Fragmentation and vivid encounters with disagreeable resistance can also stimulate an invigorating, life-enhancing aesthetic experience, as theorists of the sublime have long recognized. If contemporary art's most intense experiences often belong to this disruptive, yet vitally exciting kind, then an updated naturalism can accommodate such an aesthetics of resistance, one that sees art's value in its ability to disturb and oppose social conventions through its experiential power of defiance, even if that oppositional power also partly relies on social convention. But in critical contrast to aesthetic naturalism in all its varieties, what I call historicism defines the concept of art more narrowly as a particular historical cultural institution produced by the Western project of modernity. Partisans of this view construe earlier and non-European artistic forms not as art proper, but as objects of craft, ritual, tradition, that at best are precursors or imperfect analogs of autonomous art. The historicists stress the point that our current concepts of fine art and aesthetic experience did not really begin to take definitive shape until the 18th century, and that they only achieved their present autonomous form through social developments of the 19th century that established the modern institution of fine art and that culminated in the turn of the century's notion of art for art's sake. In the words of the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, probably the most rigorous and systematic of today's aesthetic historicists, and I quote, It is not at all in nature that the foundation of the aesthetic attitude and of the work of art is truly located, but rather in the history of the artistic institution which creates the very social conditions of possibility for art and aesthetic experience. Thus, although appearing to be a gift from nature, the eye of the 20th century art lover is really a product of history, end of quote. 20th century art, the historicist argument continues, has taken this autonomy and turned art into its own preeminent purpose and its own prime subject matter. Just as art is held to be the product of its socio-historical differentiation from real-world contexts, so art's meaning and value are seen as constituted simply by the social institutional setting which distinguishes art from the rest of life. It is, of course, the socio-historical institutional setting that makes a ready-made, object into a work of art and distinguishes it from its ordinary non-artistic counterpart. Museums, galleries, and other art institutions do not therefore simply display art. They help create the social space without which art cannot even be properly constituted as such. Bourdieu is joined by the analytic philosophers Arthur Danto and George Dickey in stressing this point. These and like-minded historicists therefore conclude that it is only through the historically changing social framework of the art world that an object becomes an artwork. Its status as such therefore depends not at all on beauty, satisfying form, or pleasurable aesthetic experience, which contemporary art has shown to be inessential, if not altogether dépassé. Some historicists moreover insist that even the seemingly wider notions of aesthetic object and aesthetic enjoyment, without the further more distinctive claim of artistic status, are likewise determined by the historical institution of art, because that institution is held to have determined the general form that any aesthetic appreciation should take by having defined the very meaning of the aesthetic. How then should we choose between naturalism and historicism? It seems folly to simply choose one of these polarized views, since each, I think, has severe limitations. If the naturalistic view does not sufficiently account for the social institutions and historical conventions which structure art's practice and govern its reception, the socio-historical view cannot adequately explain the ends for which art practices and institutions were developed, what human goods they are meant to serve, and why non-Western, non-modern cultures also pursue what seem to be artistic practices. To define art simply as the product of modernity puts in question the deep historical continuities that constitute the tradition of Western art from Greek and Roman times through medieval and Renaissance art into the modern period where art is finally said to originate. Another reason why we should not simply choose between aesthetic naturalism and historicist conventionalism, between lived experience and social institutions, is that these notions are as much interdependent as they are opposed. Our very notion of a natural language, which is nonetheless constituted by social conventions and history, shows the folly of the natural socio-historical dichotomy. Natural life without history is meaningless, just as history without life is impossible. But if it seems foolish to choose between viewing art as natural and viewing it as non-natural, since socio-historical, there remains a troubling tension between the two approaches. On the one hand, naturalism sees art's most valuable essence in the vivid intensity of its lived experience of beauty and meaning, in how it directly affects and stimulates by engaging themes that appeal most deeply to human nature and interests. On the other hand, there is the historicist insistence that art's crucially defining feature has nothing at all to do with the vital nature of its experience, but rather resides in the historically constructed social framework that constitutes an object as art by presenting it as such and institutionally determining how it should be treated or experienced. On the one hand, we see the demand for experiential intensity and meaningful substance. On the other, the requirement of a social frame without which no artistic substance, hence no experience of art, seems possible. I want now to suggest that the idea of art as dramatization provides a way of reconciling the residual sense of conflict between these poles of aesthetic naturalism and socio-historical contextualism by combining both these moments within its single concept. In contemporary English and German, there are two main meanings for the verb to dramatize that parallel the two moments of experiential intensity and social frame. In its more technical meaning, to dramatize means to put something on stage, to take some event or story and put it in the frame of a theatrical performance or the form of a play or scenario. This sense of dramatize highlights the fact that art is the putting of something into a frame, a particular context or stage that sets the work apart from the ordinary stream of life, and thus marks it as art. Art is the staging or framing of scenes. The familiar French synonym for this sense of dramatize is, of course, mise en scène, a convenient term which Nietzsche himself used in Ecce Homo to praise the artistic genius of the Parisians. He writes, "Nowhere else does there exist such a passion in questions of form. The serious in mise en scène, it is the Parisian Ernst par excellence." End of quote. But besides the idea of staging and framing, dramatize also has another main meaning that suggests intensity. To dramatize, says the Chambers Dictionary, that's already the Chambers 21st Century Dictionary, is, I quote, to treat something as or make it seem more exciting or important, end of quote. The German Duden Fremdwörterbuch makes the same point for German. Dramatisieren, to dramatize, means etwas lebhafter, aufregender darzustellen, to make it livelier, more exciting, to present it in a livelier, more exciting manner. In this sense of art's dramatization, art distinguishes itself from ordinary reality, not by its fictional frame of action, but by its greater vividness of experience in action, through which art is opposed not to the concept of life, but rather to that which is lifeless and humdrum. Etymologically, our concept of drama derives from the Greek word drama, whose primary meaning is a real deed or action, rather than a formal framing or stage performance. This suggests that drama's power derives partly, at least, not from the framing stage, but from the stirring energy of intense action itself. For action is not only a necessity of life, but a feature that invigorates life. But how can we make sense of any action without grasping it through its framing, context, or situation? I shall return to explore this intimate connection of action and place, symbolized in the Tatort of my title. But let me first underline the point already made, that dramatization effectively captures both moments, active intensity and structural frame, that the naturalist and contextualist theories respectively and contrastingly advocate in defining art. The idea of art as dramatization may therefore serve as a handy formula for fullness, synthesis, and reconciliation of this long-standing and, I think, futile aesthetic debate. To ensure that we are not building too much philosophy on the meaning of the single word dramatization, let me turn to the synonym that many in German prefer to use, and that synonym is Inszenierung. The conference where I gave this talk was a conference in the Frankfurt Opera devoted to art as Inszenierung. The conference idea was that there are now more operas than ever before, but there are no new works, so all of the art has gone into the mise en scène, the dramatization, the Inszenierung, and the Germans are very theoretical people, so they wanted to have a conference about it, and I was the one who had to open it. The synonym that many in Germany prefer to use is Inszenierung, a term which clearly echoes the French term mise en scène. Both terms, of course, derive from the Latin scena, the stage or scene of the theater, which derives from the Greek skene, whose primary meanings were not initially theatrical, but rather generic designations of place, a covered place, a tent, a dwelling place, a temple. The concept of mise en scène or Inszenierung, with its direct invocation of scene as stage or place, seems to emphasize art's moment of frame rather than the moment of intensity or action or experience. But we should not conclude that it therefore ignores this other moment that we found in the concept of drama. First, mise en scène implies that something significant is being framed or put in place, The scene of mise-en-scène is not a blandly neutral space, but the site where something important is happening. Even the very word scene has come to connote this sense of intensity. In colloquial speech, the scene denotes not just any random location, but, as one says in English, where the action is. It denotes the focus of the most exciting things that are happening, for example, in the cultural life or nightlife of a city. To make a scene in colloquial speech is not simply to do something in a particular place, but to display or provoke an excessive display of emotion or active disturbance. In short, just as the action of drama implies the frame of place, so the place of scene implies something vivid, vital, exciting that is framed. This reciprocity of heightened experience and specially significant place, we need to emphasize, is not a mere superficial linguistic coincidence of English and German. The notion of scene as the locus of the most intense experience goes back to the deepest ancient sources. Tellingly used by Euripides to denote a temple, the word skene, along with its derivative skenoma, also served as the ancient Greek term for the holy tabernacle of the Old Testament, where God's presence was said to dwell. In the original Hebrew, the word for tabernacle is mishkan, which is derived from the word for divine presence, shechina. Thus, the scene of skene means not simply the place of a play, but the dwelling of God, the sacred site of divine activity and experience, a locus of overwhelming exaltation. For as the Bible repeatedly declared, and now I cite from Exodus, the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, end of quote, exuding so much divine intensity that even the steady Moses was overcome. This Hebrew skene, the Mishkan, was the theater that God commanded Moses to build for him from the voluntary donations of precious metals, cloth, and jewels collected from all the Hebrew people. Its crucial sacred importance is witnessed through the detailed description of its complex construction and ornamentation, which fills the final six chapters of the book of Exodus. Thus, the divine roots of drama, or mise-en-scène, its role as a holy locus of intense experience, is vividly present also in ancient Hebrew culture, not just in the Greek cult of Dionysus, to which Nietzsche, a minister's son after all, later pays tribute. Drama, as Aristotle long described it, is the presentation of heightened action within a well-structured formal frame of, quote, a certain definite magnitude, a well-constructed plot with a clear beginning, middle, and end, end of quote. That's from the Poetics. If the deep drama that defines art in general is a complex play of heightened experience and formal frame, then good art should ignore neither of these moments. To concentrate solely on the frame will eventually degenerate into bare and barren formalism, where art remains alienated from the inspiring interests and energies of life. But to dismiss art's respect for cultivation of its frame because of a frantic lust for experiential intensity would threaten a parallel artistic wasteland, the empty clutter of shallow sensationalism devoid of any enduring form, so that we might eventually lose the very capacity to distinguish particular artworks from each other and from other things. Even those genres like performance art and happenings that most effectively challenge the rigidity of art's separating frame nonetheless rely on some sense of this frame in order to claim their artistic status and give themselves the meaning they intend. But if good art must be fundamentally dramatic in the double sense we have identified, that is, as intense experience captured and shaped within a special formal frame, how do these two dimensions of drama, intensity of experience and formal staging, fit together? How compatible can they be? They seem to pull in different directions, especially when we accept the popular presumptions that lived fervor cannot tolerate formal staging, and that art's distancing frame conversely subverts real-life intensity of affect and action. art's power might be better understood by challenging these dogmas. So I shall conclude by arguing that the apparent tension between art's explosively vital life feeling and its formal frame, a tension that underlies the conflict between aesthetic naturalism and artistic historicism, should be seen as no less productive and reciprocally reinforcing than the familiar tension between content and form, to which it seems related. A frame is not simply an isolating barrier of what it encloses. Framing focuses its object, action, or feeling more clearly, and thus it sharpens, highlights, enlivens. Just as a magnifying glass heightens the sun's light and heat by the concentration of its refracting frame, so art's frame intensifies the power its experienced content wields on our affective life, rendering that content far more vivid and significant. But conversely, the intensity of feeling or heightened sense of action that is framed reciprocally justifies the act of framing. We do not frame just anything. A frame with nothing in it would be unsatisfying, so that when we find an empty frame or plain white canvas hanging on a gallery wall, we automatically project a significant content onto the apparent emptiness, even if it be the interpretive content that art need have no other content but itself and its essential aspect of framing. Music can produce its own similar examples. In short, just as action makes no sense without the notion of a framing place where the action occurs, so our sense of frame, place, or stage has the prima facie implication that some significant activity inhabits that frame. Great writers like Henry James, and we're in a writer's house after all, great writers like Henry James are therefore praised for rendering their fictional scenes so captivatingly real, not by providing intricately long descriptions of their physical setting, since such description can be tediously deadening, but instead through the compelling intensity of action that takes place within that setting, including the action of passionate thought and feeling. This lesson of aesthetic realism finds confirmation in the psychological theories of Henry's famous brother, the philosopher William James, who argues in his Principles of Psychology that our immediate sense of reality, and I quote, means simply relation to our emotional and active life. In this sense, whatever excites and stimulates our interest is real, end of quote. Although art's dramatizing frame can heighten reality through its intensification of feeling, we should not forget the frame's contrasting function, one which is far more familiar to our thinking about art. A frame not only concentrates, but demarcates. It is thus simultaneously not just a focus, but a barrier that separates what is framed from the rest of life. This important bracketing effect, which tends to derealize what is framed, not only helps explain the long aesthetic tradition of sharply contrasting art to reality, but also forms the fulcrum for influential theories of aesthetic distance. This bracketing aspect of the frame clearly inspires aesthetic historicism, which we saw defines art and the aesthetic by their social differentiation from other realms, entirely in terms of the special historically constructed institutional framework that makes an object an artwork or renders its appreciation a distinctively aesthetic experience. In this productive tension that binds art's heightened experience to its formal staging, another strengthening strand should be noted. It is precisely the bracketing off of art from the ordinary space of life, which is what affords art its feeling of lived intensity and heightened reality. Because art's experience is framed in a realm alleged to be apart from the worrisome stakes of what we call real life, we feel much more free and secure in giving ourselves up to the most intense and vital feelings. As Aristotle already suggested in his theory of catharsis, art's frame permits us to feel even life's most disturbing passions more intensely, because we do so within a protected framework where the disruptive dangers of those passions can be contained and purged, so that neither the individual nor society will suffer serious damage. Art's restraining frame thus paradoxically intensifies our passionate involvement by removing other inhibitions to lived intensity. Art's fictions are often said to feel far more vividly real than much of what we commonly take as real life. It is as if art's bracketed diversion from ordinary reality allows us an indirect route to appreciate the real far more fully or profoundly by putting us somehow in touch with a reality that is at least greater in its experiential depths of vivid feeling. This argument seems clearly prefigured in Nietzsche's famous praise of drama for piercing the everyday veil of solid separate objects, an Apollonian dream world of clear forms and distinctive persons governed by the principle of individuation, so as to deliver our experience to the deeper Dionysian reality of frenzied oneness. Some might protest that such arguments corrupt the very meaning of reality, which must be reserved for the world of ordinary life and kept absolutely distinct from the notion of art with its frame of staging, the sign of the unreal. To reply to such protests, one could invoke the constructed fictions and staged experiments which form the respected realities of science. But we should also note that the realities of everyday life are everywhere played out on the stages set by diverse institutional frames. Indeed, from certain lofty yet familiar perspectives, it seems that all the world's a stage, as Shakespeare tells us, where life itself is but a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. In the ancient quarrel between philosophy and poetry, one wonders whether art is denigrated as a staged imitation of life because real life is itself modeled on dramatic performance. I shall not venture further here into the question of the real nature of reality. This seems a hopeless question, partly because reality is an essentially contested concept, but also because it is based on a grammatical substantive that is derived from the very flexible adjective real, which, as J.L. Austin showed, is so peculiarly variable and complexly contextual in usage that any attempt to find a significant common core that constitute reality is doomed to failure. Instead, let me conclude by recalling the paradox that art's apparent diversion from real life may be a needed path of indirection that directs us back to experience life more fully through the infectious intensity of aesthetic experience and the release of affective inhibitions. This suggests that the long-established art-life dichotomy should not be taken too rigidly, that we have here at best a functional distinction which surely seems to dissolve with the idea of the art of living. But I think the logic of this paradox has still more radical implications for the defense of a concept far more despised than art for its frivolous diversion from reality. I refer to the term entertainment, which past philosophers often used to denigrate the dramatizations of opera, but which now chiefly serves to condemn today's more popular artistic forms, including TV dramas like Tatort, whose very title we have seen captures not only the deepest dimensions of art, but the crucial practical and spatio-temporal dimensions of human life. Etymology also reveals that the very meaning of entertainment, or its German term, Unterhaltung, concerns the maintenance of life. If entertainment's much-denounced diversions from real life can serve, in fact, as necessary valuable detours that enhance life's journey and that help recharge the batteries of our human vehicle, then they also, partly through these functions, allow us sometimes to perceive the world more fully and deeply. From the findings of neurophysiology and somatics, we could make a cognitive case for the value of entertainment's relaxing diversions. On the basic sensory motor level of perception, If we relax from the stress of chronic muscular contractions, the increased muscle relaxation will allow for heightened sensitivity to stimuli and therefore provide sharper perception and deeper learning. This particular line of argument needs much more detailed elaboration. It belongs to a larger project I call somaesthetics. But the life-enhancing values of entertainment is anyway evident and even acknowledged by canny cultural theorists like Hannah Arendt, who condemn entertainment as the enemy of true culture and art. Thank you. So I can field my own questions. There might be people. What's the format here, Aaron? Okay. I mean, in Frankfurt, there was after the talk, there was a reception, and then Don Giovanni. We won't try to repeat that. Yeah. Okay.
One question, which is about something that is not central, maybe in your presentation, which is about when you talk about the sublime and the aesthetics of resistance. Uh-huh. I was wondering whether to generalize the issue in your somaesthetics, you could give a place to something like, let's say, Adorno's notion.
Well, no. I mean, I think that's very perceptive, Jean-Michel. I mean, I added that paragraph specifically with Adorno in mind, because in terms of the general setup, he is like, a tier. He doesn't fit neatly into the naturalist category, because the naturalists I cited are also positive about art's experience. On the other hand, he doesn't fit into the historicist category so well, because he cares so much about aesthetic experience. I mean, that for him is incredibly vital. If we want to talk about Adorno specifically, I think he belongs in the broadened naturalist camp, because of his concept not only of aesthetic experience but of mimesis. It's just that he has a recognition that the powers of experience are not only sweet and wholesome and organic, but also very disturbing, and in certain times much better because of that. I mean, I also think that in a certain way, he embraces both dimensions. I mean, I think, he would be sympathetic to this idea of keeping the two together, although he would not like the idea of reconciling. For him it would be, these are two poles and they can't be reconciled because, life sucks, and you all know how it continues. But I think he would want to keep, as someone who followed the Lukashian Marxian thing on the one hand, and the Nietzsche on the other, and the Freud.
But beyond that,
yeah.
What is your take on, the issue of, say, Kafka, Beckett, high modernism as the art of negativity, contestation?
Yeah, I mean, it's very convincing this time of year. I don't reject it. I think we do have, you can be a party member and, always like, the same, there are people who want to have the same lunch every day. I mean, we all know people like that. But Yeah, I don't think there's anything. I think there's something life-enhancing in negativity. I think that was an insight that that Nietzsche saw, and so there's no problem in the dark and the gloomy. You have storms even before modernity. With the sublime, death is also part of life. It's just a very kind of like hallmark idea of what life is. That I don't know. All things bright and beautiful. Life is more than that. And I think a substantial naturalism has to take care of that. I mean, the other question that I'm always asked is, am I a naturalist? I'm not a pure naturalist. I mean, the idea is that both of these things have to be together, and to anticipate a question, I mean, I have to apologize, this is not a premiere. So it's very hard at this time of the year to have a brand new paper. But so I know some of the questions, and I can anticipate one of them is, why am I emphasizing in terms of the rhetoric? I imagine that there are writers and literary type people here. I'm a philosopher by profession, and usually literary people are very aware, more aware than we are, of like the rhetoric. And so the rhetoric makes me look like I identify more or less wholeheartedly with the naturalist side. But that is also because they get very little playing time these days. I mean, in my discipline, it's almost all the historicist conventionalist line. And sometimes, in order to show the balance, you have to raise your voice or emphasize or stress, one of the sides. As Aristotle said, and I guess I'm sounding like a closet Thomist with all these citations of Aristotle, to reach the mean, sometimes you have to like go for the extreme, because things are like a bit distorted, I think, towards the just presumption that the historicist picture is the full and complete and correct version. Yeah.
I was wondering when I was listening to your talk about the concept of power. How would you differentiate the type of ritualized behavior that you have from ritualized behavior in general? Let's say, is it necessary? Is it useful to draw that?
Well, I mean, ritualized in a
ritual.
Okay. No, because I thought the first time I thought in terms of obsession, ritualized. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. I mean, Well, I think there's a continuum. I mean, where do you draw the line? I think you have to look at the culture, and in some cultures, it's very difficult. I had a Fulbright student who came to do doctoral dissertation with me. He was from Malawi, and he wanted to do it on the aesthetics of possession dance. That was a long time ago when I was already, he couldn't do that in our department because it was too complicated for a philosophy department. But a point is that possession dance in Malawi straddles religion, art, medicine, and I guess you could say like community politics. And so I guess your question becomes important in a particular or a reasonably particular setting.
Yeah, because I wonder if historicists wouldn't come. Yeah. I agree with you, but the problem really is how we get from there to
Well, the historicist, I don't think is concerned so much with The Starsis can tell a story of how autonomous art developed, but it starts already in the 18th century, where, you know, we have art forms, you know, some that we still very much admire, and they don't recognize. It becomes internal to the practice. They don't recognize the wider ends that practice serves. Now, when can take altar painting, or take even, you know, a painter like Caravaggio that we kind of look at in the museum. But if you go to Rome near Piazza del Popolo, you can see at least, I think two of his paintings still in altar pieces. Now, when people go to church and use these art objects as means of devotion and spiritual uplift and even prayer, are they looking at art? Are they not looking at art? I mean, it can be like, when does it have that autonomous function? But I think I would emphasize more the continuity, and I would want to say that, you know, there is that art still exists in churches, and the fact that it's used for religious purposes doesn't exclude it, you know, from being art, in the same way that I guess a lot of Hebrew, Jewish art, since there was this commandment against, making representations, you know, went into wine cups, other sort of decorations. I mean, the problem, I don't think there will be any satisfactory general definition of art that is going to answer all the cases, because your reasons for classifying one thing as art or not, at being art or not art, is going to depend on your purposes of classification. And this is something that there's a great wasteland of philosophical writing in the analytic tradition in which I was educated, which is devoted to trying to figure out one of these kinds of definitions, which ends up simply, when they're more or less successful, they end up really not saying anything, but being, you know, they're just bland formalisms that say, well, it's anything that anyone in the art world or in the past art world said rightly or will say is art. And so it's good practice for, like, drawing up divorce agreements or contracts, but it really doesn't help you understand, you know, what. And so that was the initial part about my approach to definition. So my approach to definition isn't an approach that is aimed at demarcating, because I think those demarcation things are made better by historians who trace past demarcations, critics who have a performative role and actually make things significant art. Make it art by talking about it, curators. And I think philosophers here and as usual are more or less bringing up the rear. And it would be better if they would use their attention to look at things as a whole instead of trying to and see what's interesting and fruitful for understanding, rather than trying to, like, you know, make a little box, you know, that where you can get some things in, but, you know, not other things. So that's my response to that.
Yes, you in the middle.
It's the common man, especially in America, the man on the street in America, uh-huh. Art really kind of dramatizes something about their nature, or do you think they're just engaging it physically to be entertained and to kill time?
Well, I mean, I don't really meet, it depends on, like, which street. I mean, like, you know, I don't want to be evasive, but I want to be.
Do you think the art still serves that role as?
Okay. So let me. Yeah, that I think is an important question because there are a lot of roles here. I mean, one of the roles, what I think is a really important and troubling question is. Does art ever anymore have that kind of like powerful role, right? That kind of transformative role that was so important for modernism, for Kafka and Beckett and Adorno and that and modern art, Artaud. I mean, that kind of does it have that kind of tabernacular power, and in some ways, there are people who say, well, it's gone. I don't do psychological surveys. I know there are a lot of people who are still very much moved by. We're talking about ordinary people, so-called ordinary people. In French, the term is much more derogatory. It's sort of like common, vulgar. But here, we're, I guess, a more democratic country, so it doesn't have that pejorative sense. But leave intellectuals and art lovers out of it. I mean, I think people are moved by films. And by novels, which doesn't necessarily mean what they're moved by is wonderful, but I think art still has that potential. I think that potential has that potential because we have real needs for it. I mean, this is where I go back to my my uncivilized, unrepentant evolutionary naturalism. I mean, we have through our biology and anatomy, but also through our social conditioning, we're taught to appreciate and look for intense experiences sometime. That's why we have like birthday parties, that's why people get involved in all kinds of substances. It's not just to be like negative or rebellious. Getting high on all kinds of things and enjoying intensity. I mean, that's why people do sports, not just for like billion-dollar sneaker endorsements. It's why people do business and still do business when they've got more money than they and their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren can ever spend. There's that excitement of making a deal. I mean, people like drama. I mean, why do you think I came here? I mean, partly I came because I identify with the project, right? I think Aaron is doing something very exciting. I like to get out of, now with Bin Laden we have this metaphor, get out of the cave of philosophy. Most of the time I sort of hide out in my cave, and occasionally I get on my horse, ride through the desert, and come and meet, a different population. But I could stay at home. I'm perfectly comfortable there. Why do we have these kind of events? You can read the text online. In fact, you can read it probably in a week or so in the Journal of Aesthetics and Art Criticism, where it will be published in a slightly longer version. But people come because there's this kind of urge to be together and to have some kind of experience that's, you know, different. You know, I could go, you know, skydiving is more of a buzz than talking to a bunch of, like, civilized academic type folks. But still, you know, this is better than just watching TV because it has that kind of stuff. So I think I think people still have it. You know, it could be the Super Bowl. It could be the World Series. I mean, they have this drive. I think it's important. More important, I think the idea that art can only be appreciated from this historicist perspective actually discourages those kinds of experience and makes them seem uncivilized and unworthy. And it's possible that it's conceivable that if all the ordinary people studied philosophy the way most people think of art now and took aesthetics courses, maybe they wouldn't feel it anymore, right? Or maybe if they would feel it, they wouldn't tell people about it. You know, which is also something, yeah.
When you were taking this question, kind of shying away from making a centralist definition of art. But in your essay, it seems like you separate art from not art as autonomous art. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering just like what you feel about that, whether that autonomy, that ability to be separable from social significance, historical significance, traditional significance, is that... Could that be an essentialist definition?
Well, I think let me make clear. The idea is that the historicist account identifies art per se with autonomous art. That's not my identification.
Okay.
Yeah, my identification is much broader. I mean, I write a lot about the arts of living. Jean-Michel was kind enough not to mention that I'm also like a somatic therapist, so I also like do arts of healing. I've written a lot about, you know, the popular arts that don't get considered autonomous art. So the autonomous art, that's what the historicists identify as art. So to the extent that I was doing that at a certain stage, I was taking on their perception for the sake of exposition. But I don't think, to be honest, I mean, what I'm suggesting is that there are basic things. I mean, there are basic things that are important to art. You know, one is this kind of intensity of experience or action, and the other is frame. Now, what does that mean, essential, right? Now, I think it's essential has a few different meanings, like lots. It's not as bad as real, right? Because one meaning is simply very, very important and deep. And to that extent, I think these two components are essential. Essentialism is the other, in the philosophical sense, is that it's something that picks out all and only those things that are art. So I don't think these two characteristics pick out all works of art and only works of art, because there are lots of bad works of art that don't have that, but they're still works of art. So this definition is not an essence that anything for that is a work of art would have to have that. There are also things that aren't works of art, not because they're not good, but just because, you know, we don't particularly want to classify them. You know, I can imagine, I mean, or we could debate about whether to classify them. A conversation can be like that, you know, that has this intensity of experience and a particular frame. A ball game can be like that. A meditation can be like that. But we wouldn't want to call those works of art. So what I'm saying is, I'm not essentialist in that sense, but I'm willing to, the point is to say that there are things that are important, and, yeah.
I mean, would you say that maybe they're not deliberate works of art, maybe just like craft art, or
yeah.
Maybe they're not deliberate works of art, but they can be seen artistically.
Yeah, or they can be seen aesthetically. Yeah, that's fine. I mean, you know, they're, and this is what makes the continuity, and this is why there's a lot of truth in historicism, because what we call works of art is partly a factor of these kinds of things that are exhibited also elsewhere, but also largely a factor of historical classifications, you know, which is why a certain book is classified as philosophy or is classified as psychology or is classified as literary theory. I mean, to some extent, the bookstore and its historicist conventions will give it a label, even though there are a lot of things that they're dealing with the same subject. So, yeah. Yes?
You talk about entertainment and diversion, but how is entertainment still possible, when, especially in forms of mass entertainment, we are sort of stuck in this sort of cynical reproduction of the banality of life within like capitalism?
Uh-huh.
Like, how are we supposed to move past the idea that the our problem with mass entertainment sort of gives us a very reified version of what life is, and use that as some point to move away from that and towards the top of the therapeutic aspects of sitting down and relaxing and, you know, watching the German series or many American replicants of it.
Do yeah.
We always end up stuck back in that frame and within that banality?
Well, I mean, I think part of the idea of, I think entertainment can be banal and still be entertaining. And,
is that dangerous?
Well, so are lots of things. I mean, you know, so are lots of things. I'm not trying to be arch. I should keep this on for the record. The value of art is also valued for entertaining. It's revered, to make a contrast for, let's say, other things. I don't think there's anything wrong with watching something or reading something as escape literature. I mean, if we want to take Adorno actually wasn't even so much against that. His concern was something that you echoed, is that you don't escape far enough, because what you're being offered is just an affirmation of what is out there anyhow. But I don't think that's, from my experiences of life and TV sitcoms, that's not the case. But let me put this rhetorically. This is always a question that comes up, because that's probably the most provocative remark. I gave this lecture the people who invited me were philosophers, but they were. It was a very big, very ritzy event. It was sponsored by the Deutsche Bank, Hilton Hotel, and Mercedes-Benz, and so one of my jobs was to give. Well, no, it was just to do a talk that the sponsors could appreciate, which requires that they understood it. And you know, this is why, you know, it's I hope very accessible. On the other hand, I was told that I should be provocative, so I had to put something in the end. But the idea of entertainment comes is because art itself, in terms of the history of art, was often considered simply entertainment. I mean, if you read Montaigne, whom I read for, I don't know whether it's for education or entertainment. I mean, KRS-One has that great album, Edutainment, where the things kind of get fused. But he regarded all literature, all like fiction, plays, actually even Plutarch's Lives, as entertainment. I mean, that's, you know, he would divide his books into, you know, the books that he read, be it, you know, the Bible or, I don't know, law books or philosophical essays. But everything else that was imaginative literature for him, you know, was entertainment. He didn't think there was anything wrong with that because the idea of entertaining and relaxing and diversion is something that allows you to let go a bit. And when you let go a bit, then you can absorb things and take things in and digest things. Let me be, you know, since I'm in a provocative question, let me kind of crank things up and say, well, let's say television is so relaxing that we just go to sleep, you know? Is it going to have a kind of therapeutic, useful function to that extent? Aren't I taking relaxing too far? And what I would say to that is, to the extent that there are two ways of answering that, and I haven't really decided which is the best and to what extent they are actually consistent. One of them is to say that, you know, if you're actually falling asleep, I mean, that then you're not reacting to the entertainment. I mean, you're not taking it in at all. The other way, which is more interesting, is to recognize that that in sleeping and in letting go, there is a lot of learning that takes place. You'll find this, I guess you can find it in all kinds of walks of life. Sometimes when you try to learn something, to like skate, to play an instrument, to master some language conjugation, or to struggle with an idea, it doesn't work, and then you go to sleep, and suddenly in the morning you can do it. I mean, there's a lot of working, mental work, that goes through when one is resting. So those are two ways of making it more, of appreciating the value of entertainment as diversion and relaxation. And that's actually how people who are very critical of mass culture in the way you are, and, you know, I am not, I'm not a big proponent of mass culture in mass. What I recognize is in Pragmatist Aesthetics and actually in performing live, I make an important distinction, for me important, between popular art and mass art, where popular art, it doesn't have to be for the widest common denominator, because you can get very, very narrowly focused interest groups of age, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, which are large enough to support a popular art network, but they certainly don't represent the general homogenous mass culture idea. But the point is, even on the kind of worst mass level, Hannah Arendt and other people have made the argument that entertainment is not only, you know, necessary but useful, because people need that moment of relaxation. This is one of the functions of art. I don't think it's, you know, the main function, but I don't think relaxation and entertainment are something that should be scorned. It's not something to devote your whole life to, right? But I think that's also true for philosophy, you know, or for literary scholarship. Yes.
Two more questions. One would be, so according to your definition, PBS television would qualify as art.
PBS what?
Television would qualify as art.
No, not necessarily. I'll go back to the questions here.
Okay.
I mean, I think there are a lot of, like, documentaries there, or just what do they call it? Fundraisers. I mean, that also goes on PBS. I wouldn't call that art either. But, yeah. But, I mean, maybe you weren't here when I dealt with those questions of demarcation. That's not, you know, really what I'm looking for. Because no answer that anyone will ever give is going to answer that question in a substantive, useful way.
And the second one is, have you seen the movie Waking Life yet?
No.
You should.
Okay. Is it playing here? I have a 4-month-old daughter who's like making Waking Life it's playing all the time. But I'll go and see it.
Chris.
Yes. What you?
And the urban culture project,
okay.
Which brings us to the art in the street, maybe, I hope. And
okay.
Maybe because of your traveling and experiences with other cultures, you could tell us how do you perceive urban culture in different countries, or at least maybe even Philadelphia, contrasting with other places. And before that, I'd like to say something that might be helpful. I'm a teacher too, and in the definition of art, opposing the philosophical or theoretical relative definitions, there is a very blunt definition that was given in the United States, and it's very helpful, and it meant a lot in this country, despite the fact that a lot of people don't know about it. When Brancusi's pieces were imported to the United States.
That's right. That's the customs officer's definition. That's right.
In 26,
I believe, or around the 20th. And the owners, the buyers,
a very rich collector, still could not bring them without paying customs, and they sued the customs, and the judge gave the definition.
That's right. And that was useful for that purpose.
Absolutely, it was useful.
But,
that's right.
But, yeah.
And the judge said that these pieces, the issue was that they are commercial, because they were very simple, essential metallic bronze,
right.
Elongated birds, very simple.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things, I'm not that kind of an artist, but one of the things that I always think that I would think now would be very interesting would be to try to, bring an artwork, you know, as like a pistol or something like that, an aircraft. I mean, I'm just waiting for someone, you know, to do this. Well, no, I mean, just, you know, because, you know, is that, you know, I'm trying to convince, or another kind of like blunt, dangerous instrument. I mean, you know, the judge's verdict might be overruled. You know, and
but
so,
the judge,
yeah.
The judge had a very common sense answer, and he said,
yeah.
I'm looking at this piece, and it gives me pleasure, and it's art, so be it.
Yeah.
And about the economy of art, where we draw the line, but about your UNESCO project and some more of a...
Well, yeah, I mean, the UNESCO project is called Music. Yeah, it's called Music, which stands for Music, Urbanism, Social Integration and Culture. That's the acronym. And it's about, yeah, it's a study of how music can serve as a friendly, integrative area where different ethnicities and groups can mix. And it's being directed by UNESCO, and we're collecting materials from various countries. I can't really say that it's progressing in as fast as I would like to progress, because I have other responsibilities, and UNESCO is a very, how can I put it, difficult and bureaucratic. Yeah, that's right. That's all right. Yeah, it's a very difficult and bureaucratic institution, which has just had a change of leadership. There used to be, I think he was Spanish or Argentinian, Federico Miro. I think he was Spanish. And now they've got a new Japanese director who's much more conservative in terms of budget. And so, so that's what the idea is. And
is it supposed to be a study?
Oh, no. What will it be in the end? No, that's right. What the end products of the project, we hope, will be a CD and a textbook and a CD that will describe the culture of cities, the philosophy of cities, and how music and theory of music have played together in history, in how people conceive of life together in cities, and how contemporary examples of music's functioning in an urban environment as ways of integrating different cultural groups. So,
how many countries are you covering?
Well, we have studies. Yeah, no, we have. We have 5 targeted ones initially, but and it's still at. It's been a long time, but things move very slowly.